And good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show. Coming to you from our studios right here in exciting El Paso, Texas. Gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. Well, it's an interesting day. It is July 24th. The 205th day of the year, leap year is 206th in the Gregorian calendar. 160 days left until the end of the year. In 1132, the Battle of Nocera between Ranulf II of Alife and Roger II of Sicily. 1148, Louis VII of France lay siege to Damascus during the Second Crusade. Interestingly enough, even though I think there were either 9 or 11 crusades, only the first one was successful. And, of course, the Albigensian Crusade, the church literally destroyed society in southern France to root out those Cathars, don't you know? 1304, Wars of Scottish Independence. Stirling Castle fell to Edward I of England using the War Wolf. 1411, Battle of Harlow, one of the bloodiest battles in Scotland, takes place. 1412, Benham Hedlolo becomes Syriac Orthodox Patriarch of Marden. 1487, citizens of Leeuwarden, Netherlands strike against a ban on foreign beer. Gotta have that beer, you know. 1534, French explorer Jacques Cartier plants a cross on the Gaspé Peninsula and takes possession of the territory in the name of Francis I of France. 1567, Mary, Queen of Scots, is forced to abdicate and replaced by her one-year-old son, James VI. Oh, yeah. Can't trust those toddlers. They'll put together a coup in a Mississippi minute. 1701, Antoine de la Mothe Cadillac founds the trading post at Fort Pontchartrain, but it becomes the city of Detroit. 1783, the Kingdom of Georgia and the Russian Empire signed the Treaty of Georgievsk. 1814, General Finis Real advances toward the Niagara River to halt Jacob Brown's American invaders. That was during the War of 1812. 1823, Afro-Chileans were emancipated. 1823, in Maracaibo, Venezuela, the naval battle of Lake Maracaibo takes place. Admiral Jose Prudencio Padilla defeats the Spanish Navy, which culminates the independence of the Grand Colombia. 1847, after 17 months of travel, Brigham Young leads 148 Mormon pioneers to Salt Lake Valley. That's where they established Salt Lake City, so they could worship the way they wanted to worship. Also in 1847, Richard March Hoe, American inventor, patented the rotary type printing press. 1864, American Civil War, Battle of Kernstown. Confederate General Jubal Early defeats Union troops led by General George Crook in an effort to keep him out of the Shenandoah Valley. 1866, during Reconstruction, Tennessee becomes the first U.S. state to be readmitted to the Union after the Civil War. 1901, O. Henry is released from prison in Columbus, Ohio. Served 3 years for embezzlement from a bank. 1910, the Ottoman Empire captures the city of Skoder, putting down the Albanian Revolt of 1910. 1911, Brigham Young III rediscovers Machu Picchu, the lost city of the Incas, after he had been told there were no lost cities to be found. 1915, the passenger ship SS Eastland capsizes while tied to a dock in the Chicago River. 844 passengers and crew were killed in the largest loss of life disaster from a single shipwreck on the Great Lakes. 1922, the draft of the British Mandate of Palestine, formally confirmed by the Council of the League of Nations, went into effect September 26, 1923. That whole area has been at war ever since. 1923, the Treaty of Lausanne, settling the boundaries of modern Turkey, signed in Switzerland by Greece, Bulgaria, and other countries that fought World War I. 1924, Themistocles Psophilos becomes the Prime Minister of Greece. 1927, the Menengate War Memorials unveiled at Ypres. 1929, the Kellogg-Briand Pact, renouncing war as an instrument of foreign policy, goes into effect. It was signed in Paris, August 27, 1928, by most of the leading world powers, and then ignored. 1935, the Dust Bowl heat wave reaches its peak, sending temperatures to 109 degrees Fahrenheit in Chicago and 104 degrees in Milwaukee. 1937, Alabama drops rape charges against the Scottsboro Boys. 1943, Operation Gomorrah begins. British and Canadian airplanes bomb Hamburg by night, and American planes bomb the city by day. By the end of the operation in November 1943, 9,000 tons of explosives will have killed more than 30,000 people and destroyed 280,000 buildings. 1950, Cape Canaveral Air Force Station begins operations with the launch of a bumper rocket. 1959, the opening of the American National Exhibition in Moscow. Vice President Richard Nixon and Soviet Premier Khrushchev have a kitchen debate. 1963, the ship Blue Nose 2 is launched in Lunenburg, Nova Scotia. It's a major Canadian symbol. It was a schooner. 1966, Mike Rapelke makes the first base jump from El Capitan along with Brian Schubert. Both came out with broken bones. Base jumping has now been banned from El Capitan. Base jumping means you jump from a high point of land as opposed to jumping from an airplane. 1967, during an official state visit to Canada, French President Charles de Gaulle declares to a crowd of over 100,000 in Montreal, "Vive le Québec libre," long live free Quebec. The statement angered the Canadian government and a lot of Anglophone Canadians. 1969, Apollo 11 splashes down safely in the Pacific Ocean. 1974, Watergate. U.S. Supreme Court unanimously ruled that Nixon did not have the authority to withhold subpoenaed White House tapes, and they ordered him to surrender those tapes to the Watergate special counsel. 1977, end of the four-day-long Libyan-Egyptian War. 1980, the quietly confident quartet of Australia wins the men's 4x100-meter medley relay at the Moscow Olympics, the only time the U.S. has not won the event at the Olympic level. 1982, heavy rain causes a mudslide that destroys a bridge at Nagasaki, Japan. 299 people die. 1983, the Black July anti-Tamil riots began in Sri Lanka. Kill somewhere between 400 and 3,000, depending on who you talk to. Black July is generally regarded as the beginning of the Sri Lankan Civil War. 1983, George Brett, battling for the Kansas City Royals against New York Yankees, has a game-winning home run nullified in the Pine Tar incident. 1987, U.S. supertanker SS Bridgeton collides with mines laid by IRGC, causing a 43-square-meter dent in the body of the oil tanker. 1987, Hildur Crooks, 91 years old, climbs Mount Fuji, becomes the oldest person to climb Japan's highest peak. 1998, Russell Eugene Watson Jr. bursts into the United States Capitol and opens fire, kills two police officers. He's later ruled to be incompetent to stand trial. 2001, Semyon Saxe-Coburg-Gotha. The last Tsar of Bulgaria, when he was a child, is sworn as Prime Minister of Bulgaria. Becomes the first monarch in history to regain political power through the democratic election to a different office. 2001, the Bandaranaike airport attack is carried out by 14 Tamil Tiger commandos. 11 civilian and military aircraft are destroyed and 15 are damaged. All 14 commandos are killed. 7 soldiers from the Sri Lankan Air Force are killed. And 3 civilians and an engineer die. This incident is said to have slowed the Sri Lankan economy. 2013, a high-speed train derails in Spain, rounding a curve with a 50-mile-per-hour speed limit. It rounded the curve at 120 miles an hour. Killed 78 passengers. 2014, Algeria flight 5017 loses contact with air traffic controllers 50 minutes after takeoff. It was traveling between Ouagadougou, Burkina Faso, and Algiers. The wreckage is later found in Mali. All 116 people on board are killed. Well, let's see, we got a lot of births and deaths on this date in history. In holidays and observances, the Carnival of Owassou in Tunisia, Children's Day in Vanuatu, Christian Feast Days, Charbel in the Maronite Church, Christina the Astonishing, Christina Bolsena, Dicklin of Ardmore, John Bosty, Kinga of Poland, Martyrs of Damiel, Manafrida of Cornwall, Sigalina of Albi, Pioneer Day in Utah, Police Day in Poland, Simon Bolivar Day in Ecuador, Venezuela, Colombia, and Bolivia. And in Venezuela, we also have Navy Day. Let's see what else we got. In 1534, Jacques Cartier lands in Canada and claims it for France. 1832, Benjamin Bonneville leads the first wagon train across the Rocky Mountain by Wyoming South Pass. And let's see. Spanish army and German mercenaries conquered Namur in 1577. 1577 is also the treason of Don Juan in Brussels. 1581, the states of Holland and Zeeland recognized by William of Orange. 1651, Anthony Johnson, a free African American, receives a grant of 250 acres in Virginia. 1673, Edmund Halley enters the Queen's College in Oxford as an undergraduate. Went on to become an astronomer, a mathematician, and a physicist. Also has Halley's Comet named after him. 1683, the first settlers from Germany to the U.S. leave aboard Concord. I know what has happened here. Looks like I lost part of my screen. In 1692, the French defeat William III of England at Angen. 1704, English and Dutch troops occupied Gibraltar. 1712, the French under Villars beat the Dutch army at the Battle of Denain. 1758, George Washington elected to the Virginia House of Burgesses representing Frederick County. 1783, Georgia becomes a protectorate of Tsarist Russia. 1793, France passes the first copyright law. 1823, slavery is abolished in Chile. 1824, Harrisburg, Pennsylvania newspaper publishes the results of the first public opinion poll, which showed a clear lead for Andrew Jackson, U.S. a general who went on to become president. 1833, the HMS Beagle departs Maldonado, Uruguay. 1851, the window tax is abolished in Britain. When they couldn't think of anything else to tax, they taxed you on the number of windows you had in your house. 1863, the battle at Battle Mountain in Virginia. 1877, first time federal troops are used to combat strikers. 1880, the first commercial hydroelectric power plant in the world begins operating, generating electricity in Grand Rapids, Michigan. 1883, Arabi Pasha declares a holy war in Egypt. 1886, China takes the British protectorate of Burma. 1900, there was a race riot in New Orleans. Two white policemen are killed. 1902, in Turkey, the Sultan Abdulhamid, under pressure from within the Ottoman Empire, appoints a commission to consider reforms that might pacify Macedonian revolutionaries. Treaty of Interest in 1905. Tsar Nicholas II of Russia, Emperor Wilhelm II of Germany, signed the Bjelko Treaty. Each country agrees to come to the other's defense if attacked by European powers. They were cousins. A third cousin was the King of England. 1910, Matador Juan Belmont, who was 18, killed his first bull in the bull ring. 1917, the trial of Dutch exotic dancer Mata Hari begins in Paris for allegedly spying for Germany. It was claimed that she caused the death of 50,000 soldiers. You know, the story of Mata Hari is quite interesting. Her real name was Margarita Gertruda Zella. She was actually Dutch. Executed by fire squad for spying for Germany in World War I. Now, her guilt was debated for decades after she was killed. But German documents unsealed in the 1970s show that she was actually a German agent. She acquired her stage name, Mata Hari, which means Eye of the Day, or Sun in Malay, while living in the Dutch East Indies, which is now Indonesia. And it was also in the Dutch East Indies that she learned the exotic dances that would later make her famous. She was born August 7th, 1876, in Leeuwarden, Netherlands. And she was executed October 15th, 1917, by a firing squad. She was 41 years old. Well, in 1895, at the age of 18, she married Dutch colonial army captain Rudolf McLeod in Amsterdam. Performed her first dance in 1905 in March at the Guillemette Museum in Paris. 1917, arrested in Paris on suspicion she was a German spy. In July of that year, she had a trial. And in October, she was executed. Now, interestingly enough, let's see. She became Agent H-21 for the Germans in 1916. Fell in love with a Russian officer, Vladimir Demaslov. He was 21. When he was blind and injured at the front and sent to recover in France, she asked French Army Captain Georges Ledoux permission to see him. And he agreed on the condition she worked for French intelligence. Now, it appears that the Germans learned nothing useful from her and knew she was working for the French. So they're the ones that turned her in. One of her lovers, Major Arnold Colley, a German military attaché, sent a message in code he knew had been cracked by the French and identified her as a spy. She was arrested in Paris in February 1917. During her trial, she was interrogated by Captain Pierre Bouchardon, military prosecutor, who said that her way of living was evidence that she was guilty. And she is supposed to have said, "A courtesan, I admit, a spy, never." Well, clearly, she didn't get a fair trial. And I understand how that can be. But there's some evidence that Georges Ledoux set her up, maybe even falsified evidence against her. It was a desperate time for the French. Vast war casualties and morale was unusually low. Arresting a double agent showed the French war effort wasn't as bad as it appeared. Now, there was no evidence ever presented that showed that she caused the fatality she's supposed to have caused. And there's also no evidence she passed on any information of value beyond gossip. Well, she refused to blindfold at her firing squad. Some accounts say she blew her executioners a kiss. Other accounts say she merely raised her hand in farewell to the nuns that had looked after her in prison. The interesting thing is expediency was desired over truth. And that's something I'm very familiar with. I see it every day in my dealings with the federal government and government agencies. Well, we have going to talk about secret societies today. Well, there's no question that some secret societies are more dangerous than others. So you have to ask yourself, who are the most dangerous members of the various secret societies that exist? Who are the people with power to change our lives and direct the course of history? According to a lot of sources who came inner knowledge of the group's true purposes, these people are actually Freemasons. Now, Masonic conspirators choose international leaders, launch wars, control currencies, infiltrate society, among other applications that are hidden powers, or at least according to the conspiracy theories there. When anyone questions this, conspiracy theorists trot out an impressive array of proof, beginning with the recital of the influential men through history who are undeniably associated with Masonry, including many men who signed the Declaration of Independence. I mean, who holds higher positions in the American pantheon of heroes and great thinkers than Benjamin Franklin, George Washington, and Andrew Jackson? Well, it might surprise you to know that all three were Freemasons. In fact, at least 25 U.S. presidents and vice presidents have been active, enthusiastic supporters of Masonry. Two of them, Harry Truman and Gerald Ford, boasts 33rd degree status, the highest level of recognition within the organization. It's a remarkable achievement, this elevation of a private club with secret rituals into an incubator of leaders and visionaries and intellectuals. On its face, the Masons appear to inspire men of exceptional talent, far beyond that of any other organization, whether you're talking Boy Scouts or Rhodes Scholars. So you have to ask yourself, what are the values and systems that breed these overachievers? To a few fanatic historians, almost all of them who are Masons, I might add, at the root of their achievements, a historic, inspirational link with the Knights Templar. This organization began as nine knights who claimed to be the defenders of the Christian faith, went on to become the bankers of medieval Europe, and succumbed to the machinations of a greedy king and a complicitous pope. Once acclaimed and admired for chivalrous deeds and good works on behalf of Christianity, the Knights Templar safeguarded the pilgrims on their way to the Holy Land. They fought Islamic armies for control of Jerusalem. There were genuine knights in an era when that title brought respect and admiration. And they rigidly obeyed the rules of chivalry and asceticism, dedicating their lives to the glory of God and the protection of Christian pilgrims. That was the public admirable side of the society. The darker side had rumors of associations between Templars and the Assassins, the replacement of Templar moral values with outright greed, a decline in commendable character traits, and the pursuit of various obscene and blasphemous practices. Now, these attributes are not a model for any high-profile organization seeking respect, let alone one that prides itself on providing world leaders and community benefits. The dark complexity and suspicion provided the necessary intrigue and color for a later group whose original objective was to protect the secrets of tradesmen. Along the way, the Templar spiritual leader managed to be compared to and maybe even mistaken for Christ himself. Now, you have to understand, the Templars were a product of the Crusades. And the Crusades, contrary to popular belief, were the result not of chivalrous intent or even a dedication to the Christian faith, but a feudalistic obligation. As is their manner, historians vacillate much about the definition of feudalism as due about its structure, and a few now reject the very notion of a feudalistic age. Well, whatever titles given to it, Europeans living during the period between 800 and 1300 experienced a way of life that bridged inchoate barbarism and the roots of democracy. During this time, kings had claimed wide authority over lands we now know as France, Germany, Britain, but frankly, the countryside was ruled not by monarchs, but by individual lords and barons. Dominating the lands encompassed by their estates, the lords dispensed justice, levied taxes and tolls, even minted their own currency and demanded military service from citizens occupying those lands. In fact, most lords could field larger armies than could the king. The king was actually often a figurehead ruler. The social structure was many-layered and clearly defined. Serfs were the lowest level, performing basic labor and having no claim to any wealth they created. Vassals worked the land on behalf of the lord. Knights, whose primary qualities including sufficient funds to own both a horse and armor, performed services on behalf of the lords, and the clergy administered spiritual assistance as required. Now, the lords themselves, in turn, were considered vassals to more powerful rulers, and all were formally considered vassals to the king. Now, feudal loyalty actually flowed in two directions. The citizens made an oath of loyalty to the lord, paid taxes imposed by him, and attended the court when they were summoned. The lord's obligation included protecting the vassals from intruders, but frankly, this act was as much in the lord's interest as in the vassals. Out of this linear arrangement, subjected to the influence of Christianity, came the concept of chivalry. Vassals and knights, heeding the rights and property of their feudal lord, elevated the notion through terms such as proud submission and dignified obedience, inspired maybe by biblical tales of Christ's actions. Phrased in this manner, behavior that appears to mirror a master-slave relationship was spun into something more reputable and uplifting. As contradictory as it might sound, individuals could have elevated their status by lowering their position on behalf of some splendid goal. Popular literature suggests that the incentive for chivalrous behavior was a romantic interest in an elegant lady who had stolen the knight's heart, and to whom he pledged eternal reverence. In reality, a knight's proud submission was made either to God or to the Lord who controlled the knight's destiny. The romantic aspect of Cerberus' behavior, glorifying womanhood in a manner that combined worship of the virgin with suppressed sexual desire, remains an inspirational source for a lot of fiction, but basically a byproduct of a deeper motivation. Chivalric demands were rigid. Obligations were expected to be fulfilled, and vassals and knights accepted a sacred duty to defend by arms the honor and property of the class above them. Since the pyramid structure of medieval society set Christ at the apex, lords, knights, and vassals alike were equally obligated to defend his rights and honor. With feudalism solidly established throughout Europe, lords and knights, accompanied by a retinue of servants, began the practice of making pilgrimages to Jerusalem as a means of expressing their Christian faith. Reviving a concept dating back to the early Greeks who trekked to Delphi in search of wisdom, European Christians began setting off on pilgrimages to the Holy Land, first in honor of Christ and later as a means of cleansing their sins, and later still in response to direct instructions from the Pope. Interestingly enough, one of the benefits that you could get by following the Pope's dictates to go to the Holy Land, you were automatically, in advance, forgiven for any sins you might commit. You could commit murder, and that was okay because you were there serving the Lord. Prominent early pilgrims in search of spotless souls included Frontman of Brittany, who murdered his uncle and younger brother, Fulk of Nera, Count of Anjou, who burned his wife alive, which was evidence of serious marital discord and abuse even in these tumultuous pre-feminist times. Both men sought forgiveness with a pilgrimage to the Holy Land, and both achieved success, although in something of what you might call contrasting measure. After years spent wandering the shores of the Red Sea and searching the mountains of Armenia for relics of Noah's Ark, Frontman returned home swaddled in the warmth of forgiveness for murdering his relatives and passed the remainder of his days in the convent of Redon. For his sins, Fulk de Nera wandered the streets of Jerusalem covered by a retinue of servants who beat him with rods while he repeated the words, "Lord, have mercy on the faithless, perjured Christian, on a sinner wandering far from his home." And his apparent sincerity impressed the Muslims so much, they granted him entry into the room of the sacred tomb, normally forbidden to Christians, where he threw himself prostrate upon the bejeweled floor. While wailing for his wretched soul, of course, de Nera managed to detach and pocket a few precious stones from the site. Even when asking for forgiveness for sins, the idea of profit is never far from one's mind. The example set by Frontman, de Nera, and others had their impact on devout Christians. Around 1050, making a pilgrimage to the Holy Land was considered a duty for every able Christian as a means of assuaging guilt and appeasing the wrath of God. And the church began assigning a pilgrimage as a common means of penance. By 1075, pilgrimage trails had become as well-defined and as well-traveled as trade routes. The pilgrim's trek, usually tracing the Adriatic coast before turning overland to Constantinople and across Asia Minor to Antioch, was neither more or less dangerous than any other journey of similar length. Their established route, though, proved a factor in 1095 when Byzantine Emperor Alexius Comnenus pleaded for Pope Urban II to send help in defeating a group of Muslim tribes known as the Seljuk Turks. After seizing Anatolia, the Byzantine Empire's richest province, the Seljuks occupied Antioch, Tripoli, and finally Jerusalem itself. And at this point, it seems that they had their eye on Constantinople. If the Pope could organize an army of dedicated Christians to assist Byzantine troops, Alexis suggested, together they could retake Antioch and restore Jerusalem itself to Christian rule. Now, the promise of Christian rule over the Holy Land, bolstered by expectations of wealth tapped from the Byzantine emperor's own treasury, was enough to inspire Urban II to launch the first papacy-sanctioned holy war. So began almost 200 years of horrific slaughter on both sides. It began with a goal as much mercenary as it was spiritual. And in 1096, the first of 9 crusades set off. Inspired by Urban's cry, Dus Volt, God wills it. Now, of course, he didn't take his fat ass to the Holy Land. Deciding to take part in a crusade was a serious decision, even for the most devout of Christians. It meant at least 2 years of travel across rugged and often hostile country, although later crusades reduced the time by sailing eastward along the Mediterranean from Provence. Seeking food and shelter during the long journey from Europe to Palestine and back, pilgrims and crusaders had to deal with open hostility from both the Muslims and the Greek Orthodox administrators. In response, Gerard de Martinez established a hospital in Jerusalem to serve as a refuge. Consisting of 12 attached mansions, the facility included gardens and an impressive library. Soon, local merchants created an adjoining marketplace to trade with the pilgrims, paying the hospital administrator 2 pieces of gold for the right to set up stalls. Kind of like a trade show, I guess you could say. And this was too good for feudal entrepreneurs to ignore. When the flow of pilgrims swelled an endless flood, a group of Italian traders from the Amalfi region established a second hospital near the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. This one operated by Benedictine monks with its own profitable marketplace. Soon the second facility was overflowing, promoting the monks to create another hospital, dedicating it to St. John the Compassionate. Well, the men of St. John the Compassionate elevated the concept to a new spiritual status. They devoted their life to maintaining safety and comfort for pilgrims by treating their patients as their masters, creating a prototype for every charitable organization it followed, although none matched their dedication and humility. This practice, of course, reflected the true origins and goals of chivalry, attracted many knights who set aside their military objectives in favor of emulating the most charitable of Christ's teachings. Their military bearing and discipline were never wholly discarded, though. Among those they served, the knights were liberal and compassionate. Among themselves, they were rigid and austere. They pledged vows of poverty, chastity, and obedience. Their dress became a black mantle bearing a simple white cross on the breast. They were called the Sovereign Military Order of the Hospital of St. John of Jerusalem of Rhodes and Malta, or simply the Hospitallers. Vows of poverty, chastity, and obedience may have suited their obligation to chivalrous behavior, and I'm sure they anticipated they were going to heaven when they died. But they did little to protect the Hospitallers from the dangers of attack by various factions in the Holy Land. With time, the Hospitallers grew focused almost as much on their military actions in defense of their order as on their acts of benevolence. Most were armed knights, after all, noble of birth and adhering to the high standards of true chivalry. And they were also as human as anybody else of that era of ours. And when powerful European duchies expressed admiration for the Hospitallers by awarding them extensive lands in Europe, they accepted these donations gladly. In addition to this source of income, they assumed the right to claim booty seized from defeated Muslim fighters, and by the time Gerard died in 1118, the Hospitallers had acquired substantial assets from their patrons and with it exceptional independence from church authority. What began as selfless dedication to the poor, injured, and diseased, it evolved into an organization more akin to what you might call a modern-day service club, whose well-heeled members were least as interested in fraternal association and public status as they were in helping their neighbors. Now, the Hospitallers may have been capable military men, but their reason for being continued to be public service. Battling Muslims while fulfilling their obligation was proving a distraction from their primary goal, and others needed to direct as much energy into fighting the enemy as the Hospitallers were investing in caring for the Christians. Now, I'm sure it's viewed as cynical to imply the wealth accrued by the Hospitallers as a result of their charitable services inspired their more celebrated brethren, but frankly, history suggests it did play a great role. In any case, a new society was formed within 10 years of Gerard's death, comprised originally of 9 knights led by Hugh de Payen. The followers claim the same ascetic and pious characteristics that distinguished the original hospitallers. This new group, though, focused on the hazards faced by pilgrims and crusaders. By now, the distinction was going blurred and almost meaningless during their trek to the Holy Land and their stay in Jerusalem. Now, there were many hazards that had to be faced. Egyptians and Turks resented passage and intrusion through their countries. Islamic residents of Jerusalem objected to the pilgrims' presence. Non-nomadic Arab tribes attacked and robbed the travelers, and Syrian Christians expressed hostility toward the foreigners. Much of the group's early reputation for humility and valor was rooted in Dupin's personality. He was described as sweet-tempered, totally dedicated, and ruthless on behalf of the faith. To the modern sensibility, the concept of being sweet-tempered and ruthless might appear to be contradictory, but to medieval observers, they were perfectly compatible. A battle-hardened veteran of the First Crusade, Dupin took delight in counting the number of Muslims he had killed without apparently souring his day-to-day charitable mood. And why should he? The even more pious Bernard de Clairvaux had declared that the killing of Muslims was not homicide, but malicide, the killing of evil. Thousands of dead Muslims in the Holy Land may have begged to differ, but nobody paid any attention to what they thought. So Dupin, single-minded to the exclusion of everything except the worship of God and the slaughter of Muslims, gathered men around him who committed themselves to protecting pilgrims from danger in the same manner that Gerard's hospitallers were healing and feeding them. This new group, Dupin's announced, would combine the qualities of ascetic monks and valiant warriors. They'd live a life of chastity and piety, employ their swords in the service of Christianity, and to achieve them in achieving this somewhat contradictory role, I guess you could say. They chose as their patroness La Dolce Mira Ledu, the sweet mother of God, and vowed to live according to the canons of St. Augustine. Baldwin II, who was ruling as King of Jerusalem, was sufficiently impressed with the group's character and goals to award them a corner of his palace for their living quarters, and he gave them an annual stipend to support their work. Access to their quarters was through a passageway adjoining the church and convent of the temple, and so they called themselves the soldiery of the temple, or the temples. Templars. Let out one more time. With time, the Templars impressed various noblemen who offered the same kinds of financing arrangements as the hospitallers enjoyed. When one French count announced he would contribute 30 pounds of silver annually to support the Templars' activities, others followed suit, and soon the movement was awash in the kinds of riches it originally planned to reject. To their credit, for the first several years of their existence, at least publicly, the Templars resisted temptation to use their growing wealth for anything except the support and defense of pilgrims. 7 years after the group's official formation, Bernard de Clairvaux wrote of the Templars, "They go and come at a sign from their master. They live cheerfully and temperately together without wives and children, and with that nothing may be wanting for evangelical perfection without property, in one house, endeavoring to preserve the unity of the spirit and the bond of peace, so that one heart and one soul would appear to dwell in all of them. They never sit idle or go gaping after news. When they're resting from warfare against infidels, not to eat the bread of idleness, they employ themselves in repairing their clothes and arms, or do something which the command of the master of the common good enjoins." Well, this, frankly, in spite of rumors to the contrary, was not exactly a life of what you might call beer and skittles. Even the Cistercian monks, who represented a model for the Templars, sought pleasure from life while managing to avoid the risk of death on the battlefield. Under these circumstances, only men of the highest character, most sincere virtue, could endeavor to enjoy a career as a Templar, but among ambitious and pious young men, the call of chivalry was difficult to ignore. Impressive numbers of them sought membership in the Templars, swelling the ranks and raising the group's profile among European nobility, who expressed their support by pledging money and land, and sometimes their own sons. Well, as membership in the Templars grew, a formal structure was imposed on the organization. There are actually three classes: knights, who were men of noble family; neither married nor betrothed, and who bore no personal debts. Chaplains are required to take vows of poverty, chastity, and obedience, and serving brethren, men of wealth and talent who lack the noble birth requirement of the knights. Eventually, the brethren were divided into brethren in arms who fought alongside the knights, handicraft brethren who performed menial chores of baking, smithing, and caring for the animals. They were held in the lowest esteem within the order. Both knights and chaplains were required to undergo a rigid initiation process. You know, once again, the first ones there decided what the others had to go through in order to be members. And this practice, extending to modified form down to the present day, forms the root of the perception of Templars and their descendants as a secret society. On the evening of a nominee's reception into the order, he was inducted in the presence of the other knights within a chapel. No one else could be in attendance, nor could the candidate divulge when, where, or even if the ceremony was taking place. The procedure focused on warning the aspirant of the difficulties about to encounter, demanding he swear allegiance to the Templar's purpose before God. Reading an account of the ceremony today suggests the initiation was a form of middle-age boot camp. When he wished to sleep, the candidate was told he'd be ordered to watch. When he wanted to watch, he'd be ordered to bed. When he wanted to eat, he'd be ordered to work. Could he agree to these conditions? And each demand was to be answered clearly and loudly with the response, "Yea, sir, with the help of God." The initiate was to promise never to strike or wound a Christian, never to receive any service or attendance from a woman without the approval of his superiors, never to kiss a woman, even if she were his mother or sister, and never to hold a child at the baptismal fount or be a godfather, and never abuse any innocent man or call him foul names, would always be courteous and polite. Well, who could resist an order dedicated to such chivalrous behavior and high Christian principles? Certainly not the church. In 1146, Pope Eugenius III declared the Templar knights could wear a red cross in their white tunic. This was chosen to be in direct contrast with the Hospitallers. In recognition of the martyrdom they faced and that they were henceforth free of the direct papal supervision, including the risk of excommunication. Now, this papal favor generated an even greater flow of lands and castles and other assets into their treasury from oppressed patrons. Now, there's no infinite resistance to perpetual temptation, and the seeds of the organization's downfall were soon sown. Rumors spread the Templars were engaged in extortion from the assassins. This claim arose from the murder of Raymond, Comte de Tripoli, assumed to have been carried out by the assassins. In response, the Templars entered the territory controlled by the assassins, but instead of challenging them to battle, they demanded a tribute of 12,000 gold pieces. Now, while there is no record that the assassins made any payment of this type, sometime later they dispatched an envoy to Omri, the then king of Jerusalem, offering to convert to Christianity if the Templars would forego the tribute. So clearly there was some sort of accommodation that had been reached. Later, Templars intercepted Sultan Abbas of Egypt as he fled into the desert with his son, his harem, and a goodly portion of stolen Egyptian treasure. After killing the Sultan and seizing the treasure, the Templars negotiated a deal with the Sultan's enemies to return the son to Cairo in exchange for 60,000 gold pieces. Now, this may have been business as usual for the times, but the son had already agreed to convert to Christianity, which should have been enough to justification to spare his life. Instead, when the Templars' deal with the Egyptians closed, the son was put in an iron cage and sent back to Egypt, where he and the Templars both knew he faced death by protracted torture. Incidents such as this marked the decline of the Templars from an Asiatic order dedicated to protection of the poor and helpless into an organization focused on material gain as much as any modern-day corporation. In fact, they set up an extensive banking system expressly to transfer money and treasures between Palestine and Europe, an action totally unrelated to their purported oaths of charity and poverty. You know, it's interesting how the powers that be can justify anything and everything. I was just pulled away from the microphone to take a call from the Office of Inspector General of the VA. Supposedly, they're there to report violations too. In actuality, they're there to be part of the old boys club. I've got a doctor who refused to look at my symptoms. I'd been exposed to toxic mold. But his statement to me was, well, I can't say that because I'll have to write a letter, and I'm a doctor, not a secretary. I'm going to say you have asthma because I have shortness of breath and all the things that go with mold exposure. So he sent me out to a pulmonologist who confirmed exactly what I had said. And rather than letting this man treat me, my referral was canceled. Because if the specialist said the doctor was wrong, the doctor might have to write a letter. So I now have a permanent disability caused by the what is clearly malpractice. And the VA is about to herniate itself trying to cover up for the doctor. And yes, I use that phrase knowing exactly what it means, cover up for the doctor. Apparently, disabled veterans are a nuisance to the VA. I wanted to see the director of the local medical facility, and I'm told he's too important to talk to a mere veteran. He's a very busy man. I sent an email to the secretary of the VA, Robert Wilkie. I get an email back. He's got my what I sent. Somebody's in leadership with the healthcare side of the house is going to call me. That was on Tuesday. I ain't heard anybody yet. I did get a call trying to guilt trip me into drop. I had filed a tort claim about the medical malpractice. And I get a call trying to guilt trip me into dropping it because of all the trouble I was going to cause that poor doctor. Does anybody think about the person who's going to spend what time he has left on this planet with the difficulty breathing? I went to the OIG, which is the Office of the Inspector General. I just got off the phone. That's who called me away from the phone, to the phone. No matter what was done, it wasn't a crime, and they can only investigate crimes, you know. Covering up issues, taking things out of my medical records. These were just basically all in good fun. They weren't crimes. The system is closing ranks to protect this doctor. The chief of staff at the local VA, I had talked with him about it at great length, and he was going to look right into it. Wouldn't you know, he's now retired and gone. Apparently all the documents I gave him vanished. The medical primary care physicians are broken up into teams, and I talked to the director of Team A. And I was going to be given a new doctor on Team A. And the doctor who I met with, who at great length I went over everything with, and he said he understood and going to get right on it, he disappeared too. And instead of a physician, I'm given a nurse practitioner. Great guy. I enjoyed talking with him. But his specialty was not the issues I was having trouble with. And as a nurse practitioner, he couldn't even refer me out to a specialist. So finally, they sent me to another doctor who never bothered to examine me, looked at, heard me give her a rundown of my medical situation. And she said, pulmonologist is wrong. And this was without ever bothering to look at me. You have a cough, and all you need is cough syrup. It'll cure you right up. I said, how about the pulmonary disease? I don't pay any attention to that. You need cough syrup. So they sent me out to an outside physician, since they don't have enough doctors. And I had asked for a refill of a prescription that I'd had for years. Been asking since May? Well, he said he had sent it three times. He didn't know what else to do. And the VA told me yesterday, well, yeah, they had it, but they needed a paper prescription. And I could just run over to his office and get it. I have pulmonary disease with lung scarring. I can't go out and get around a lot of people. And if I go to a doctor's office, who goes there? Sick people. Oh, well, I could just run right in and run right out. I could go so fast, I wouldn't get sick. This is what disabled veterans get from the VA? I'm just dumbfounded at the total lack of concern about the health of disabled veterans. I also discovered why I've had headaches for months at a time, because I have a severe injury to my cervical spine. Now, I've been service-connected for that since the 90s, but on this last review, a nurse practitioner, without examining me, decided, well, my cervical spine injury was actually arthritis. That's without examining me. So finally, I got sent to a neurologist who said, well, you just have migraine headaches. No, I don't. Never have. So they finally sent me to an outside neurologist who said, you got an injury to your cervical spine. And he sent me to a neurosurgeon. After the neurosurgeon examined all the tests, he said, you got a severe injury here that clearly backdates to when you were in service. And if you move the wrong way, you could wind up paralyzed. Well, it turns out the doctor who did my out-processing physical, who said I was just the picture of health, was a member of the Romanian Iron Guard, which was their Nazi party, brought over here under Operation Paperclip, and certified to be a doctor because he knew something about the Russians. Federal court found the man incompetent in his own specialty, which is ear, nose, and throat. So, I am very disillusioned by all the promises from our government that they're going to do all this, that, and the other for the disabled veteran. They're not going to do jack. Okay, that's it for the week. I'll be back on Monday, maybe. And once again, I'll be listening to Ken Hudnall and the Ken Hudnall Show. Until then, have a truly great weekend.